Everybody needs to recognize the trauma. We need to say, okay, the trauma happened. Now what do we do? How do we work with it here and now in the present?
Hi, welcome to Resonate, Conversations and Life Lessons from Rancho La Puerta. I'm Barry. I find the ranch to truly be a magical and peaceful place. It's like a respite from the craziness and the chaos of the world we live in. It's hard to imagine stress, anxiety, and trauma while you're in this beautiful place, yet it's a part of each of our lives. Guests come here to find healthy ways to deal with the traumas in their lives. If not addressed, they can lead to disease, depression, addictions, or they can manifest in other physical or mental ways. It's estimated that up to 20% of the U.S. population is on medication for either anxiety or depression, and sometimes both. My guest today is Dr. James S. Gordon. He's a Harvard-trained psychiatrist who travels the world working with people in acute trauma and stress. He served as the chairman of the White House Commission on Complementary and Alternative Medicine and has authored several books. His latest book, Transformation, Discovering Wholeness and Healing After Trauma. Dr. Gordon points out that trauma is a part of this human condition. No one gets to escape it. He believes we can grow and learn and become better people by learning to handle our traumas in healthy ways. Healthy practices like deep breathing, meditation, being with other people, physical movement, self-care, all things that are emphasized here at Rancho La Puerta. Hey, James, thanks for joining me today.
Good to be here with you, Barry.
You are a Harvard-trained medical doctor, right? A psychiatrist and author. You also have the Center of Mind-Body Medicine, and you've founded that. And are you the CEO of that?
That's true. I founded the Center for Mind-Body Medicine in 1991, and I'm the CEO, and we work with population-wide trauma here in the United States and all over the world, in war zones and after wars and climate-related disasters, right, and with indigenous people. So creating a curriculum of self-awareness, self-care, mutual help, and community building, which we've been teaching for these last 33 years.
Most of your books that I've found have trauma as kind of the central theme in a lot of the work that you do. So how did you become interested in that?
Being a psychiatrist, in a sense, the mother's milk of psychiatry is trauma. I don't think I've ever used that image before.
Yeah.
But in the late 19th century, Freud and Breuer and Janet began to become aware that the symptoms that adult people develop, some of the physical symptoms, the psychological symptoms, as they talked with those people, what they discovered that those symptoms had their origins in early childhood trauma or trauma of childhood or adolescence. Mm-hmm. So the whole basis of modern psychiatry is an understanding of the importance of psychological trauma in how we grow and develop and how we develop symptoms that may disrupt our lives. So that was there with me right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, as a doctor and as a psychiatrist, I want to be there and help people when they're in the biggest trouble. That's always been a sort of part of my nature, even when I was, before I became a psychiatrist. It was kind of, let me be there, let me be useful at a time when people really want me around. And what I discovered fairly early on is that the time of trauma in present life, or the time when the trauma of earlier life was resurfacing and causing problems or issues, that's a time when people were open to learning new things, to making new discoveries, to finding out, what do I need to know now, and what am I supposed to do with my life? And so I saw myself really from the beginning as a kind of midwife to that process.
I noticed that you said that trauma is universal, meaning that this part of being a human being means that there's going to be some trauma coming along with it, that there's no escape for any of us, really.
Here in the United States, we may be the only place in the world that thinks that might not be true, that somehow everybody can have a flawless life, or that anybody can. Mm-hmm. And that if something goes wrong, there's some kind of terrible moral failing there. Well, That's an illusion. That's an illusion in a society mm-hmm. to think that everything has to be perfect or at least look perfect on the surface, that none of us can have vulnerabilities or make mistakes. Right. And I think traditional societies all over the world understand human beings differently. And most other societies, except for the United States, do understand that, as the philosopher, reggae singer Jimmy Cliff would say, opposition will come your way. It's going to mm-hmm. happen. If it doesn't right. happen early in life because you're poor or because you live in a violent neighborhood or because there's some kind of physical disability, it may well happen in early adulthood or midlife with a major disappointment. Well, over half of Americans get divorced, who get married, get divorced.
Mm-hmm.
I have rarely, if ever, seen a divorce that was non-traumatic. We lose our grandparents. We lose our parents. And as we grow older, we lose people our age who are close to us. So, and then all of us ultimately have to deal, we live long enough, have to deal with our own physical frailty and with our own impending death. Trauma is a part of life. It's not just those other people who experience it. It's all of us who experience it.
As a psychiatrist, you can prescribe medications, but you don't prescribe medications. Is that true?
It is true. And I began to question the use of medication 60 years ago when I was a medical student, because I was not that impressed either with the results that I saw or even with the scientific literature on medication.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, when I was working with psychotic people as a medical student and as a psychiatric resident, yes, the antipsychotic medications might keep them from hallucinating quite so much and might make them calmer, but it also disturbed them and people in so many ways, psychological, emotional, shut down feelings, caused tremors and shakes and strange behavior. I didn't see the long-term benefit. In fact, I saw the long-term downside. So early on, I became interested in, was it possible to work with people who would otherwise almost invariably be prescribed medication? That is, people who were either psychotic or severely depressed, was it possible to work with them without medication, using psychotherapy, talking with them, creating a supportive environment, perhaps a variety of self activities that promoted self-expression? I began to get interested in that, 55 years ago or more. And then what happened is, as I began to use other non-pharmacological approaches to deal with whatever issues I had, whether it was anxiety or allergies or asthma or poison ivy, as I began to look at the pharmacopoeia of the world's healing traditions, particularly of Chinese medicine, also of Western naturopathic medicine, as I began to learn acupuncture and work with nutrition and learn how to do manipulation and learn a variety of kinds of meditation, I began to see there is the possibility not just of talking with people or creating a better environment, which are both, and group support, which are really important, but also of a whole lot of other tools and techniques that have a deep effect on our psychology and biology. So Hippocrates said 2,500 years ago, his first rule was, first, do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
And the medications that we prescribe all have significant side effects. They right. should not be used as a first response. If everything else doesn't work, okay. But I've been very interested in creating that model of the everything else that can work, whether it's for anxiety or depression or for psychotic people or for people who've been severely traumatized. And so that's what most of the last 50 years of my work have been about, is creating this model, which shorthand for it can be mind-body medicine, but that's not nearly inclusive. It's like an integrative medicine that combines mind-body approaches, Western biomedicine, and the wisdom of the world's healing traditions.
Do you find that there's more of a shift in our medical community? I don't know about in the United States, but it seems like when I was pre-med and got accepted to med school at one point in my life, that our medicine was more treating symptoms than the cause. And I feel like what you're saying is a little bit to that, because if you treat it with a drug, you're just masking the symptom and side effects, and necessarily you're not, it's going to come back if you ever stop doing that drug because you're not treating the cause.
Yes, there has been a change. When I started speaking this way and thinking this way, writing about this 50 years ago, there was tremendous, tremendous skepticism. Now, more and more people have become interested. There were other people like me during that time, late 60s, early 70s, who became interested in this approach. And so we did everything possible to study it, to learn it, to practice it, to bring it into the institutions where we worked. I chaired the advisory council to NIH's Office of Alternative Medicine when it was created in 1991. And then I chaired a White House commission on complementary and alternative medicine policy 2000 to 2002 under Bill Clinton and G.W. Bush. And so, yes, it's shifted. And we got, you know, we got the American Medical Association to testify to that White House commission and the Organization of American Medical Schools and Nursing Associates. But so there's openness, there's more openness, there are more people, more and more young physicians, as well as nurses and psychologists and physical therapists, are becoming interested in this approach. But the penetration is still not nearly deep enough. Many of the major health centers in this country now have integrative medicine programs where they have the kinds of meditation techniques we teach at the Center for Mind-Body Medicine that I write about in Transforming Trauma, where they have nutrition, where they have herbal therapies, where they have acupuncture. But in very few of those places are any of those techniques used in the hospital. So it's become a kind of boutique. It's called integrative medicine, but it truly, the next step is to become completely integrated so that when you go for, I just had heart surgery at the Cleveland Clinic, and the world-class surgeon did a great job, but the people from the integrative medicine program at the Cleveland Clinic, they couldn't routinely visit me on the ward and do the kinds of things that might have been helpful post-operatively, like acupuncture, like massage therapy. So it's just strange. But they have a wonderful integrative medicine program, but it's just an outpatient program. So we have a long way to go. The ideas are there, but there's still too much focus and overwhelming economic investment in those approaches that primarily treat symptoms, or those approaches like my heart surgery. I needed heart surgery. I'm grateful that I had a world-class surgeon available, but that's only because all the other approaches hadn't worked. So I think we don't have it right yet.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't even misquote myself, but the number of Americans on antidepressants and mood-enhancing and anti-anxiety medicine is staggering, you know, when I look at the figures.
Yeah, and you know, if you look at the research carefully, the results are not that good using conventional antidepressants. And the side effects are always there. Some people get better, but the vast majority don't really get that much better. And they do suffer from the side effects. But it's a terrific marketing that's been done for the antidepressants. And the other thing that's troubling is, and this is some years ago, I read a study in a family medicine journal that said that family physicians, 3 minutes after they heard a patient talking about depression, they were writing a prescription for an antidepressant. Well, that's not a way to do it. I mean, the point is, first of all, you don't have the whole picture. So you want to get to know the person fully. And then you want to look at an approach that does not, right off the bat, use antidepressants. Exercise, for example, physical exercise, the results in some of the head-to-head studies of physical exercise and antidepressants show the physical exercise does just as well as antidepressants. So why not create a program in physical exercise, which has all kinds of benefits, including the antidepressant one, as opposed to going right to antidepressants?
Is there a difference for you between stress and trauma? Is stress just a lower form of trauma?
I suppose you look at it. It's not a bad way to look at it. Stress is the wear and tear on our system. I think that the thing about stress is that a certain amount of stress is necessary. A certain amount of stress, you know, the challenges you have having a show, challenges I have running an organization, that stress, that's okay. That's what Hans Selye, who coined the term for stress in this psychological realm, what he called eustress, the good stress.
Right.
Other kinds of stress, it's kind of low grade wear and tear on you that can build up. Trauma is much more it's a Greek word that means wound or injury.
Right.
So I'm stressed because, you know, I have some work I have to get done and I have a deadline. That's stress. I'd be traumatized if I'd lost the original copy of the thing I had to work on. That I could see this trauma.
Right.
But simply having a deadline and worrying about the deadline, that's stress.
I think that some people, the word trauma seems very big and overwhelming to them. And so they don't like to admit that it's trauma that they're experiencing, maybe.
I think you're right. I mean, I think it goes two ways. I think, you know, here in the United States, particularly, we don't want to admit, you know, we're tough, we're strong, nothing right. can affect us. And then the other side is that sometimes there is a tendency that some people have to kind of endlessly indulge themselves in worrying about trauma. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the other extreme. Everybody needs to recognize the trauma, but it's also important, and that's why I begin my book, Transforming Trauma, with stories of people with the most horrible childhoods who moved through and beyond that undeniable trauma and became whole, functioning, beautiful, remarkable, creative human beings. So we need to say, okay, the trauma happened. Now what do we do? How do we work with it here and now in the present? And that's what my book, Transforming Trauma, is about. That's what the work of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine is about. It's about creating a program that you can use to move through and beyond and learn from rather than be imprisoned by your trauma.
Yeah, and I like the word transform that you use also because I wonder, like, I don't know, do you think a person ever really gets over trauma or you learn to deal with it in a different way or in a healthier way?
Well, I don't know if we ever get over anything. So everything's in code. Everything's in code.
Right.
But we become different people. And so I'm thinking of somebody I write about in the beginning of the book, a woman named, in the beginning of Transforming Trauma, a woman named Diana with horrible, horrible childhood, but who has moved through and beyond her trauma. That doesn't mean that when she sees a child abused, she doesn't have all of that sort of hurt and anger and dismay that it brings up from her own childhood. But on the other hand, she's going to do something about it. She's not going to think I should kill myself or I'm a horrible person. She's pained by it. Mm-hmm. But then that pain is a kind of catalyst for her to act, to do something about it in the moment, to calm herself down. But also if there's something she can do for that child or do for that family, she'll try to do it.
Do you think there's a lot of people that have trauma that don't realize that that's what's causing a lot of the issues in their life? And how do they come to find out what's going on inside of them?
Absolutely. You put your finger on it. Those were Freud's patients. Right? Mm-hmm. They didn't know what had happened to them. They just knew, I can't move my arm above my head. What's that all about? Or right. I'm stuttering all the time. Or I can't see very clear. So I think what happens is that many of us come to realize that we've been traumatized only when later in life we have symptoms that we don't understand, whether they're psychological symptoms or physical symptoms. And then we have perhaps, hopefully, have the opportunity to go to someone, talk with someone, and say, here's this is going on. What do you think is happening? And that they'll be talking with somebody who's not going to say, let me write you a prescription for anti-anxiety drug or an antidepressant. Right. But somebody will say, let's look at it. Let's think about it. And let's use the kinds of techniques that I describe in Transforming Trauma. Let's use those techniques to look at what's going on and to look at what your understanding is and what your potential response to that trauma is. What do you think it's going to? I always ask people, what makes a difference for you? Mm-hmm. So if you were coming to me and you were talking about, you know, how bad your tennis game is, whatever. And I say, Barry, what makes it better and what makes it worse? So right from the beginning, the idea is to engage people in understanding what's actually going on with them. And I used a you know, kind of trivial example, maybe hopefully not too trivial example, the tennis game, but it could be, you know, I'm so anxious around my wife, or I can't love my kids the way I'd like to. I don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And often enough, the root of that will be an earlier trauma.
Another example you might use, you talked about how 50% of people end up in divorce. And I think it's probably has a lot to do with two completely different people coming together and having different sets of trauma and stuff and trying to work that all out on their own.
Yes. I'm laughing because when I was still a kid, before I don't even think I was in medical school yet, a couple of us were sitting down having a beer in New York City, right near Columbia University. And one of our crew said, I'll spare you his profanity, but basically he says, everybody's totally screwed up. Whoever you're going to be with is screwed up. That's not the point. The point is whether the way you're screwed up and the way she's screwed up go together.
Mm-hmm. And
he became the provost at Columbia many years. He was a very wise man. We were 21 years old at the time.
Right.
And he and his wife were together for 50 years.
My name is Sue, and we're from San Diego.
Yeah, my name is Victor. And this is our first time at Rancho La Puerta. We were recommended this wellness retreat by some of our close friends who were just first-time guests last year.
They're here with us.
And so far, it's been an amazing experience.
When they told us about this place, we were intrigued by the fact that it's only 90-minute drive from San Diego, yet you can feel completely disconnected. So whole week of program that you focus on the well-being of not just your, you know, physical health, but also your inner health as well. And it has been truly transformative.
Yeah, and I really have been enjoying the kind of the guided hikes, the educational courses and lectures, and the exercise programs.
Mm-hmm.
Picked up a lot of new activities while I've been here, learned to play pickleball, reminded myself how to play tennis again. So it's been a lot of stuff that we don't have time for because our lives are so busy. It's been nice to have protected time just to really take care of ourselves.
Yeah, we're going back tomorrow and we'll definitely return.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely come back.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. Let's talk about some of your techniques that you use with people to heal and help them work through trauma. What are some of the non-medical things that you would suggest for people?
When you're traumatized, there are two basic biological reactions that we have to that wound, that injury.
Mm-hmm.
One is the fight or flight response, fast heart rate, muscles tense, fear and anger in the brain. The other, if fight or flight does not suffice, that is, if the trauma is overwhelming and inescapable, then the freeze response comes in and the body kind of shuts down and we put out endorphins to numb the pain. And if we're humans, as opposed to other vertebrates experiencing a freeze response, we withdraw psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
So the first two techniques that we use that I described in transforming trauma, that I use in my practice, that we use at the Center for Mind-Body Medicine, I begin by saying, as we did in the conversation, it is possible to move through and beyond trauma. You're not condemned to it for life. Mm-hmm. It's a part of life, and you can move through it. And I'm not asking you to believe me. I'm going to give you some techniques so you can begin to experience some change. And the first one I teach is slow, deep breathing. Mm-hmm. In through the nose, and we can all do this together for a minute or so, out through the mouth, with the belly soft and relaxed. Technically, a concentrated meditation. So we're focusing on the breath coming in through the nose and out through the mouth, on the belly softening and relaxing, and perhaps on the word soft as we breathe in and belly as we breathe out. If thoughts come, we notice them.
We let them come. We let them go. We bring our attention gently back to soft belly breathing.
Okay. So that's the first technique. That's the antidote to fight or flight. Mm-hmm. The second technique is an expressive meditation, that is using the body very actively. Mm-hmm. And the one I like to use almost always early on is shaking and dancing. So when you're in a freeze response and you're shut down, you can't feel much and your body's kind of numb, getting people up, having them shake, just shake their bodies, put their feet apart, maybe close their eyes, shake to fast driving rhythmic music, 5 minutes or so. Pause for a couple of minutes, just relax, and then let the body move to music that's energizing for you.
Mm-hmm.
That expressive meditation is a crucial part of healing trauma. And I really want to emphasize that, because too many therapies that address trauma are neglecting this physical expressive aspect. It is so crucial to healing trauma. Once again, indigenous people have done this for tens of thousands of years. So I learned from them originally, and I learned from them and from people who learned from them.
Can I ask you a question? The mechanism of shaking, is that physical? Is that because you're kind of getting, absorbing the hormones and the stress things that were released during trauma? Is it you're getting rid of it a different way?
Letting go of that stress, letting go of that stress that has come into the body. I don't know if you have a dog, and your dog gets in a confrontation with another dog on the street. Mm-hmm. After the confrontation's over, your dog is going to shake.
Yeah.
It's a basic biological mechanism. Mm-hmm. I mean, technically, it begins to replay what has been going on in the midbrain, the lower part of the brain, that was deep in the brain, and bring that back up through the emotional brain to the conscious brain. So it's shaking you loose from this lower brain constraint and allowing the other parts of the brain, the emotional, the intellectual part, the feeling part, to reemerge. Kalahari Bushmen are the great avatars of shaking, but many indigenous people do it, and obviously animals do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two that we begin with. And then afterwards, everything else, once you begin to come into that kind of physiological and psychological balance, all the other tools and techniques of self-care, whether it's you go for a long walk, that's part of self-care, being in nature. Mm-hmm. Maybe you learn how to eat mindfully, not just what you eat, but eating slowly. That's another self-care technique.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe use guided imagery to see how you can improve your physiological functioning and also to answer questions that have been disturbing you. Like, what should I do about this upcoming lecture that I'm totally unprepared for? Not this one, but I was like, let me ask my wise guide. Let me go and stop. Oh. Right. And then my wise guide says, don't worry, man. You're okay. You've always been okay. You don't have to prepare that much. You know what you're talking about. The more you use these techniques, the more effective they become. So the wise guide, which is a way of tapping into our unconscious or our imagination or intuition, or some people think it's a higher power, whatever you think it is,
right?
It helps discrimination. It helps decision-making from the most complex things to the simplest things. We do self-expression, words and drawings and movement. Mm-hmm. And we bring people together in groups. Very important in dealing with trauma. Whether you're trying to do this on your own or you're with a therapist, it's also very important to have other people with whom you can talk. So at Center for Mind-Body Medicine, when we do a training, we train people in a large group. Maybe 200 people come for a training. Physicians, mental health professionals, community members who want to help others in their community, volunteers. We have large group experiences, and then we will have, for those 200 people, 20 small groups. So everybody has a chance to share their experience, to share what's going on. Trauma, and this reflects on what we were saying earlier, is so stigmatized. You know, how could you let that happen to you? Or, oh, poor you. And in the context of the small group, you see everybody's got stuff. You're not alone. It's not a question of being better, worse, more or less traumatized. You're a human being and you've got issues. And the group is so helpful and so supportive for learning self-care and also for just feeling I am a part of something bigger than myself.
If everyone experiencing trauma, then, you know, I think sometimes you feel isolated and you feel alone and that people don't understand you. So I could see how the group setting would definitely help in that respect. So you've worked with a lot of people around the world dealing with some pretty extreme trauma things. I know that you've dealt with shooting and victims and also like Hamas and Israel and the conflicts there. So how do you make that work? I mean, it seems like it's like a merry-go-round going round and round. It keeps happening, you know?
First of all, I think for me, it's what I want to do. We work with New York City firefighters after 9/11 and work with their families. And some of the firefighters really got interested in our work. And they came through our complete training. They got certified. They began to share what we taught them to all the things I'm telling you about with other firefighters. And one day, about 6 months after I got to know him, this firefighter named Kevin Guy, happened to be his name, he's from the Bronx, New York City Fire Department lieutenant, one of the toughest, smartest, funniest guys I've ever met in my life. And you remember, the firefighters had lost 300 of their brothers at 9/11. So they've been through terrible trauma, 300 of the other firefighters. So Kevin said to me, he said, "Hey, Jim," this is the way you talk, "Hey, Jim," he said, "I get it. I get you. You're just like us." And I said, "Kev, that's a tremendous compliment because I admired firefighters so much. What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you like to help people and you like to be where the action is." So that's, he had me in a nutshell. That's right. I like to help people. I like to be where the action is. But once I began to see, after the first few years of starting the Center for Mind Body Medicine, that our work could be extremely helpful to doctors and mental health professionals and educators and others here in the United States, I wondered, can we be helpful in some of the most troubled places in the world? And so I began to go there and I began to see that the same kinds of techniques that we were using here could be of use, for example, to former child soldiers in Mozambique and to families in South Africa who'd lost family members during apartheid, that they could use the techniques and they could use the group model. So ever since then, a major part of our work has been on population-wide psychological trauma. And the time to work with trauma is not after the war is over, but when the war starts. So that's something I learned after working in Bosnia just after the war was over. It became clear once the war in Kosovo started, that's where we need to be. That's 1998. So I go, it's interesting, it's exciting. We can be helpful to people in a situation where they need a great deal of help. It's very satisfying. I can see the benefits. You know, I can sit thinking about Kosovo during the war, sit with a group of families bombed and burned out of their homes. We're sitting on the porch of a farmhouse. There are hundreds of people camping out. And they're drawing pictures, and they're starting for the first time to talk about how sad they are because they haven't been able to talk about that. Or working with soldiers who are picking up the bodies of the dead, and they're able to talk in our groups about how difficult it is to bring a dead farmer back to his wife. It's so gratifying to be able to help people. As far as working in those situations, I learned early on in Kosovo, that was the first war I was in, an American Fulbright colonel, he said, "Oh, no, I want no heroes here. If I say hit the ground, you hit the ground." I said, "Okay." So you do your best to take as good care of yourself as you can, not take unnecessary chances. Sometimes I go by myself. It's much better if I can go with a group of people. And so at the end of every day, we have time with each other where we talk about, you know, that was really scary, what happened there. Or I was really so angry, I didn't know what to do. So I have that social support. We have a team now. I'm not in Ukraine this time. I've been there 6 times. Since the current war began in February 2022, we have a team there now And they're with each other all the time, sharing with each other. They're teaching. They were creating a whole new faculty of 42 Ukrainian people who will be on your Center for Mind-Body Medicine faculty.
When you started the Mind-Body Medicine, what is your ultimate goal right now for your organization? Is it to keep expanding and training people so that you can have a bigger outreach on the planet?
My goal for the organization, and people should look on our website, cmbm.org. Mm-hmm. You can read about it. We have online mind-body skills groups that are available. And we also are happy to train you. Not if you're a health or mental health professional, great. But if you're a teacher, a community organizer, clergy, you're somebody who wants to help kids in your community or homeless people, we welcome you in our training. So my goal for the center now in its 33rd year is to be available to meet the most dramatic and pressing needs where they occur. And secondarily, to bring our model of self-awareness, self-care, mutual help, and community building into as many of the major health and educational and social welfare systems as we can here in the United States and around the world, to set a new standard for the care and transformation of trauma. That's what I want us to do. We can't be everywhere, but we can train, and we are working in hospitals. We're working in school systems. We're working after climate-related disasters. I want people to see what we're doing. I want people who are listening to us to see what we're doing and to join in and to bring what we have to offer to your community. I don't want the Center for Mind-Body Medicine to control what's going on. We want to give you the tools to do what you need to do in the way that makes sense to you and your community.
Well, Ed, thank you so much. And I really appreciate you talking to me today, Dr. Gordon. And it's been very insightful. And I'm excited for this to spread because it's definitely needed in our planet right now. And I hope I see you at the ranch one day.
I hope to be at the ranch. I did talk with Deborah at some point about coming. And she said, great, you come. But that was a while ago, and I still haven't gotten there. So,
well, we'll get you here for sure. So thank you so much.
I found Dr. Gordon's message today to be one of hope and resilience. The belief that we can get through tough times and with the right tools, grow, learn, and come out healthier on the other side. His work with alternative medicine and treating trauma has had an impact on the traditional medical model. Dr. Gordon does not use medications to treat his patients. He points out that many medications have negative side effects. In the acute stages of trauma, there is benefit to medicine. But ultimately, it numbs us to the pain that we're feeling, and eventually we have to confront what's causing our trauma, find healthy ways to work through it, to come out a healthier person on the other side. I found it comforting to know that everyone goes through trauma and we're not alone. We can learn and get support from other people. I encourage you to find ways to feel good. Maybe it's taking a walk in nature. Maybe it's playing a musical instrument, calling a friend, attending individual or group therapy, moving your body. But most importantly, have patience and love for yourself. Until next time, this is Barry wishing you health and daily joy.